Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And making a long-awaited return to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, Orla Shinawy.
Thank you for having me back.
Of Sky.
Sports news.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Orla, licking an ice cream cone.
We're all licking ice cream cones.
We're in Liverpool and we're overlooking the water at the waterfront in Liverpool on the Strand, where the Tour of Britain Stage 1 finished earlier today. It's beautiful sunshine and it's quite warm, really, isn't it, honest? And we saw here earlier Marcel Kittel win Stage 1. By our reckoning, his fourth victory on UK roads, not British roads, UK roads, well, this year. He won in Belfast at the Giro. He won two stages, of course, at the Tour de France. You could say his fifth win in the British Isles this year, because he also won in Dublin at the Giro as well. Orla's nodding.
Technically correct, yeah. It's a bit of a kind of controversial one. You don't like British associated with Ireland, but yeah, British Isles, yeah, we'll go with that.
Technically correct, of course, the best kind of correct.
Correct is correct.
Everyone likes a smart
So,
Lionel.
Listen, we arrived today, Lionel and I, for Stage 1. We're going to be coming out of the Tour of Britain a bit this week. Daniel Freeb is off to the Vuelta, and he'll be reporting back from the Vuelta. We'll talk a bit about the Vuelta today as well, but we're mainly going to look ahead to the Tour of Britain and reflect a little bit on Stage 1. And Orla, I think you were in Liverpool on Saturday evening as well for the team's presentation. The first time they've done a team's presentation. And you spoke a little bit to Bradley Wiggins and Mark Cavendish. Cavendish had quite a nasty crash today, we understand. Hit a car, was off to hospital. So it's again, another sort of sad chapter in his difficult season. He was still third on the stage and not that far away from Kittel. But what was the presentation like? What was the team's presentation like?
It was a fairly low-key affair, really. I think that's pretty understandable. We all get a bit used to the razzmatazz, and with every event that we have in Britain now, it gets bigger and bigger. So I'm just laughing because I've just realised that once I start talking, the two of you munch furiously and lick furiously on your ice creams.
I can also tell you're trying to speak quite quickly because you're worried that
mine is going to drip as well. Yeah,
you're gonna melt.
But no, it was a really good atmosphere. Not a huge crowd, as I say. Mark Cavendish with his Amiga Pharma Quickstep team. They were one of the last teams on stage. He didn't seem overly happy to be on stage.
That's not like Mark.
Well, we know what he's like. He doesn't always like being the centre of attention, and sometimes he loves it, I suppose, like all of us, really. But he wasn't being overly talkative, really, with the media afterwards. I got a few words with him, and he was perfectly pleasant. But he said, by his own admission, and he's said it in other print interviews as well, that he's just not in top condition. He hasn't had the racing that he would obviously usually have at this stage. He's at pains, if you pardon the pun, to point out to everyone just how bad that injury was that took him out of the Tour de France. And people expect, because it's not broken bones, that it'll heal quite quickly. But he says it'll be another few months. But the star of the show, as we would have imagined, was Sir Bradley Wiggins. They were last on stage, Team Sky. And it's always interesting with Wiggins, isn't it? You can kind of tell how he's working inside by his demeanour on the outside. And he had his customary swagger on stage. We thought, oh, this is good. We've got the confident, happy Bradley Wiggins back. And yeah, he was playful with the crowd. He took a good half an hour afterwards, actually, to sign autographs for the kids, to indulge in selfies with the bigger kids. He had a joke with one of the youngsters saying, what are you doing down here? You should be watching The X Factor. So he had his usual cockiness back, which is nice to see. So I think he's really enjoying being on British soil with British fans and getting a chance to race in front of them. He's at home, really, isn't he?
Well, he is. It's very close to home here. It's interesting, though, you mentioned it was quite low-key, and when you think about the quality of the field, it really is a high-quality field this year. Not just those two, but Kittel and Kwiatkowski and so many others, really. And it is one disappointment, I think, for the event and for those two, Cavendish and Wiggins, is that neither of them spoke to the press at all this week. Neither of them did any media in the lead up to the race. And I think that would have helped build a bit of anticipation, would have helped with the build up to the start. And, you know, we I know Lionel and I were trying, you were probably trying as well, Orla, to get interviews with them in the run up to the Tour of Britain. And you know, that was the difference between the Tour of Britain getting a lot of coverage in the newspapers this weekend and it getting nothing at all, because cycling is still, in this country, considered, rightly or wrongly, a small sport. And it's big when you have the big names and you can speak to them and you can have, you know, nice long interviews with them on a Sunday morning. And we were denied that this week. And I think the event was, as perhaps the build-up to the event has perhaps suffered a little bit from that as well.
Yeah, I mean, particularly considering it's a break from the Premier League football, which dominates so much of our written press. There's not a huge amount going on. Sorry, I'm just looking at Richard and Orla now frantically eating their ice cream.
We're onto the cones.
While mine's about to drip over the edge and onto the table. So hang on. So, yeah, I think, you know, the thing about the way cycling captures the imagination of the written press is it once it's up and running and the race is underway, it captures the imagination a bit more. But in the run-up to it, it's still quite a hard sell, even though Wiggins and Cavendish are, you know, bona fide sports stars. They're up there with, I mean, today Freddie Flintoff turned up, visited the Sky Bus and met Bradley Wiggins, and you know, he's another huge sporting star in Britain. So cycling has the capacity to attract, you know, that sort of profile of person. People like that are interested. I mean, Andy Murray visited the Sky Bus, I think,
Tour de France,
yeah. And so, yeah, it does feel like a bit of a missed opportunity when the two biggest stars of the sport don't, you know, go that little extra mile in the lead up to what is our biggest event. But then perhaps it's because we've had the Tour and the Giro here already this year. I don't know.
Also, I mean, you know, Bradley Wiggins is paid, what, £3 million, £4 million a year by his employers, Sky. They don't seem to have any sway, any influence over. Here he is competing in their colours at the National Tour. I'm still staggered. I don't know why I'm staggered, because it's happened for several years now, but I'm amazed that, you know, that it can't be sort of requirement that somebody does media in the run-up to an event like this.
I'm not sure, though, that that's not going to be a part of his contract in the future. I think that, from what I understand, we know, obviously, he is not going to win another Tour de France. He said he's not going to ride another Grand Tour. But then again, last night on stage, he did say, you know what I said about hating road racing, I didn't really mean it. I said it in the heat of the moment. He said he had 2 pints of wife beater, was his quote at the time. But certainly, he's not going to go on and dominate on the road in any way. And I think that he will have to earn his keep, really, with Team Sky going forward by being more willing on that front and being more of an ambassador, because it does not matter what that guy does. The British public love him. They love him.
Did he not also say that this Tour of Britain is likely to be the last time he ever contends for a stage race? He was going to put on lots of weight over the winter, presumably drinking lots of that beer that you mentioned. But no, he came out, one of these sort of things that Bradley Wiggins says from time to time, quite extreme and quite radical. This will probably be the last time I ever contend for a stage race.
But he also said,
until the next time.
Until the next one, this is it. Just say he says it from time to time. He says it from week to week or from month to month. And what he says on one occasion, he'll completely contradict on the next occasion, which is why we love having him as a public figure, because he's always he always gives us talking points, really, doesn't he? I can't see that he'll be able to completely go to the track and still sign with Team Sky. He did talk about his future with Sky last night briefly, said he really wanted it to work. He couldn't see himself with any other team. His ambitions in Rio are well known, and I can't see any other team that would accommodate that.
So he's not joining Team Cult Energy with Andy Schleck. Lionel, I believe you might have some information on Wiggins and Team Sky.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of gossip going around at the moment, and somebody told me that Wiggins could stay with Team Sky whilst simultaneously leaving Team Sky. Just to explain what I've heard, and I've tried to substantiate it a bit. I don't want to slip into Richard's rumours and just make stuff up off the...
Never.
Listen, let's be clear. I don't make stuff up, all right? People might make stuff up and then tell me it.
Fair point. So with all the usual disclaimers and caveats, the suggestion is that a development squad that's linked to Sky but not part of Team Sky, maybe in the offing, perhaps with sponsorship from 20th Century Fox, with Bradley Wiggins as its leader, and then a kind of development group of predominantly British riders, I would have thought, joining that team. And that could perhaps include people who are out of contract with Sky moving across. Now, there is this rule within the World Tour that every World Tour team must have a development team of some kind affiliated, and the Great Britain team that's riding here this week fills that function partly, I suppose. It kind of ticks that box. And I think there is a strong rumour that there may well be almost a feeder team to Sky, a kind of B team that's under the same umbrella with, let's not forget, 20th Century Fox, if they were to be the title sponsor of it. They're currently on the Sky jersey at the moment as one of the co-sponsors. So we'll have to see how that pans out. And I think, Orla, you were saying about Bradley Wiggins will be wanting to focus on the track leading up to Rio in 2016, and this would be the perfect way to do it, because he needs to stay in this organisation and have that freedom to do the racing he needs on the road, as well as have the time to prepare on the track. So we'll see what develops over the next few weeks.
I mean, just that it might be a good time to hear our first interview. Not that there's necessarily any connection here, but a very young, promising British rider, Tao Geoghegan-Hart, who we did a special podcast with almost a year ago. Spoke to him at the start today. Big things expected of him in the long term. Not sure how he'll get on this week, but caught up with him a year on, his first, reflecting a little bit on his first year as a senior. So here he is, Tao Geoghegan-Hart.
I wouldn't say I'm overly happy with the season, but I think it's been kind of still a step in the right direction for me, kind of towards where I see myself in the next 5 to 10 years. It's been a real good experience. I think it did prove not to be quite the step up I anticipated in the under 23 races, but certainly in the elite races it was a real insight into the level that you need to achieve if you want to be competitive in the pro ranks in the future. California was a tough race for me, as it kind of came out with a really bad injury, but at the same time it was still a great experience and something I really look to build on this winter.
I mean, I guess the priority this year was to adjust to the under 23 level, and you know, third at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, obviously that very good result at Tour de l'Avenir against riders quite a few years older than you. I mean, you know, you must, if you'd been offered that at the start of the year, would you have settled for those two results in particular?
I think it's pretty hard to say kind of what you would or wouldn't have taken, especially when you don't really know what you're stepping into. Certainly, I'm reasonably content with those results, and I feel like they go some way to reflect the work I put in and my effort towards the sport. But I think ultimately you always just push for more, and that's kind of where I stand on looking back. It's just taking, I think I probably said pretty much the same thing last year, taking the positives, but kind of more looking at the negatives and where you can improve.
California, you did end up on the podium in California after the first stage, didn't you? You were in the young riders jersey briefly, and this is a similar level of race here at Tour Britain, I guess. What are you looking for from this week?
Yeah, I mean, there's no under 23 riders jersey here, so that's kind of a little bit out the window, but I think just a nice solid performance. Again, just have a look at the level, and slightly different racing from California to here with the British roads and the way of the landscape. So I think, yeah, I'll just get stuck in, really. I think with Dan McClay, we've got like a real, real solid opportunity to get some results in the sprints. And I'd like to support him in a similar way to Avenir. So albeit it's a lot harder with big pro team sprint trains, but I think he's the type of rider who could really do a result. And on a personal level, I think just give a few stages a crack and keep an eye on the overall week as a whole and see how it goes, really. I think it's always hard to say.
So. Any stages in particular that take your fancy?
I mean, I know the tumble climb from a couple British cycling training camps in Newport over the last 3 or 4 years, so yeah, for sure. And I know now that when it goes uphill, I'm more likely to get a result than any other time, so I'll definitely give it a crack and a try. But I think it could be really tough with the pro teams and the way the races approach. You need to be really organised and be at the front for those climbs. You can't afford any mistakes, but at the same time, I like that type of racing and when it is a little bit touch and go. So, yeah, I'll give it a crack and see what happens, really.
So that was Richard talking to Teo Gegenhardt, who's riding for Great Britain. He was 10th in the Tour de l'Avenir a couple of weeks ago. This is his debut at the Tour of Britain, and it'll be interesting to see how he goes on this week. Before the stage here in Liverpool today, I spoke to a couple of people. First up, Roger Hammond, who is in the team car for the Madison Genesis team. He was the first British rider to win a stage of the new current Tour of Britain when it returned to the calendar in 2004. That was in Blackpool. And then the following year, he actually won a stage which went from Blackpool to Liverpool. And I asked him whether that stood as his favourite memory of the Tour of Britain.
I remember it being quite a complicated running with Pizzato and Boonen, who'd been dominating for the first couple of stages. And they were certainly looking good for their Liverpool stage, and they were leading out, but they made a mistake on the last corner. So I took it really tight and got a head start into the finishing straight and held them both off, which is quite nice, really. Just see a dejected Tom Boonen as well, champion in the background on the photo. And there's also... a little young Mark Cavendish floundering in the background as well. So it was, yeah, it's quite a savoured little photo I've got, actually.
Yeah, nice to have the world champion in your trailing in your wake there. You've obviously ridden the Tour of Britain several times. Now you're in the team car for Madison Genesis. How has the race evolved in the decade that it's been running?
It's changed a lot. I mean, you know, when it first came back, I think even the organisers admit there were some teething problems with it. You know, like they said in the race meeting yesterday, you know, we have 60 cars per kilometre of road compared to European countries of about 15 per kilometre. So, you know, we have a hugely densely populated country. So that has a problem when we're using, you know, public roads. So I think it takes a lot of work from them, and you know, they have to be innovative because they can't just replicate what people do in Europe and bring it over here because it doesn't work. So over the years they've discovered what works here, and it was unique to the UK, and now you have a world-class event that you always know when a race is world-class when you get the world-class riders coming and world-class teams, and they have got that. So you know, it's not really for me to say whether it's good or bad. You just have to look at the teams that are supporting it and coming over here. So, and it's right up there.
And lastly, this week, what are you looking for from your guys, and how can you help them kind of adjust to what is quite a big step up for them? This is obviously the biggest event that they'll do this year.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they all understand that this is it. But you know, what comes with stepping up to the bigger stage is the bigger prizes. You know, and that's what's on offer for those guys. You know, like I said to them, it's life changing. This can be life changing for them, and I'd love it to be life changing. But from what I want to see from my guys is I want to see six guys that just take the opportunity with both hands. You know, you know, obviously we would love success. We would love to be exposed on the television, you know, people knowing that we're in the race. But the reality is they're out of our control. You know, all we can do is go in and make the most of it that we can. And that's what I want to see from the guys. I don't want to see guys that are... you know, swamped by the situation or afraid of it. Just I want to see them going gung-ho, and they know that that's what they've got to do. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
So riding like they deserve to be here in this peloton.
Definitely. I mean, you know, these guys that are riding here, you know, everybody here has got a story. You know, there's the best riders in the world. They're not necessarily in their best form of their season here. So, you know, to write yourself off before you even start, you know, people would never thought I'd have won onto Blackpool. But, you know, I was in a three-man breakaway that's gone up on a bunch sprint stage. But if you don't try, you never win. So, you know, that's kind of the message that I'm passing across, is that don't rule yourself out and don't be afraid to lose. I mean, that's the most important thing. Don't be afraid to lose, because nobody remembers a guy that just didn't lose all week.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freen.
It's a bit like strange, a bit surreal, to be honest. You know, I used to come here every weekend, and I didn't really imagine how the cycling would go. Like, it's so huge, there's so many people around, and yeah, it's really privilege to race here.
And I'm assuming you wouldn't have imagined the centre of Liverpool shutting down on a Sunday afternoon. Huh. No Premiership football this weekend. The spotlight's on the city for a completely different reason.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just, you know, years ago it's difficult to manage. Imagine how well it would go, and it's good. It's good.
And how about with your place in the team this week? You're the leader for the GC. Is that on your mind?
I don't know, just take each day by as it comes, because it's been difficult. I've had quite a tough race program. I'm feeling a bit tired, so I'll just have to search for opportunities each day.
And any other stages that particularly stand out to you, the ones that you're looking forward to?
Nothing in particular. I think they're all good stages, and you can do something on any stage, really. There aren't the route's good and it's balanced, and there's a lot of opportunity to do things. So,
have you got a lot of friends and family out here today? They're going to be on the barriers shouting for you?
Yeah, there's a lot.
Be able to pick anybody out, or do you think it'll be a bit too quick?
I don't know, there's that many people here, you probably won't see them, but maybe you hear them, I don't know.
Excellent, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Cheers. Thanks.
So we heard there from Steve Cummings. He had a little dig towards the end of the stage. Quite a decent attack in the last 6 kilometres or so, and got a bit of a gap, but couldn't hold off the marauding bunch. You had a nickname for Steve Cummings, did you not, Orla, for a while?
I can't remember. I have a nickname for lots of people,
okay.
Richard.
She's not going to tell us what that was. but he didn't. It was a long shot, wasn't it?
Bad night. It wasn't anything bad.
Well, it was good,
all.
As I recall.
It was good, yeah.
It was flattering, I think.
So
he had a little go, maybe just wanting to show face on home roads. Like you said, he had a lot of support out there today. So it was a familiar sight in the end of Marcel Kittel powering up the finishing straight. We've seen it so many times. Just appears from nowhere. He always pays great tribute to his team, and sometimes it can be hard to tell, to see what they've done exactly, because they don't have the same approach as, say, Mark Cavendish's old HTC team had, which was total control of the peloton. They're looking after him, but ducking and diving a bit more and further in the sort of in the depths of the peloton almost. And he did say afterwards that a gap sort of opened up from when there was a crash with about a kilometre to go, and had that crash not happened, he might have found himself boxed in. Orla and I took part in a press conference with him afterwards, and we asked him a couple of questions. We can maybe hear them now, then we'll come back and maybe talk a little bit more about Marcel Kittel. So here was Kittel after the stage.
This is your fourth win in the UK this year. I think it's fair to say you're the only non-British rider last night to get a cheer from the crowd. You seem to be feeling a little bit at home here, are you?
Yeah, it's I said it already just before the podium ceremony to the TV team that I'm really happy to see the people here, and also to get that warm welcome. I think that's always very nice. And like you said, it's been always pretty successful for the team here and for me.
You've been, I mean, all I mentioned, you won at the Giro, you've won obviously on a successful tour. How are you maintaining that sort of form and that focus as the season goes on? Because it's even a long season.
Good question. it's the season is long. I was, just before I came to Britain, I thought, I started my season in Tour Down Under. When I finished Tour of Britain, I'm actually 9 months now in the racing season. So that's, when you think about it, really a lot. And of course, you've got ups and downs. I can definitely say that the highlight of my season now, the Tour de France, is over. And it's hard to keep going sometimes. I'm honest about that. And sometimes you're also lazy at home. So it's really about having fun on the bike. So sometimes I would go on the mountain bike for training, and also here it's really for me about enjoying the time that I have here. So it's nice to see the spectators, and also nice to be then with the team, have some fun, and don't be too serious always.
Will you go to the Worlds, or how are you going to, when's your season going to finish?
I will go to the Worlds, but only for the team time trial championships, and after that I will do a one-day race in Belgium, and then my last race will be the Franco-Belge in Belgium again.
Marcel Kittel then, absolutely dominant. As he said in the press conference, he's been performing for 9 months, which is about the time it takes to have a baby.
I was thinking that in the press conference. Yeah. He said it's a long time. I thought, I know. Isn't it?
9 months is a long time, isn't it, Orla?
It is a long time. My 9 months aren't up yet, if that's what you're referring to. Not my beer belly.
No,
my growing belly.
Another couple of weeks.
It's more than that.
A few weeks.
Another few weeks. I'm 8 months.
Beginning of November, if I'm
indeed,
not mistaken.
Yeah.
Maybe you have some time on your hands. Maybe you can do some more podcasts in the aftermath of.
Yeah, I'll probably just be bored, to be honest. There won't be much to do. I understand being a mother for the first time is quite dull and easy.
We can pop around and podcast.
Please do.
Keep you occupied. Anyway, Marcel Kittel, again, a sort of not only a terrific talent, but a model of politeness, charm, very easy interviewee. And, you know, no matter how many times he wins, how big he becomes, he doesn't change, does he? And he's a very down-to-earth chap.
I think he is so impressive, and I've never heard anyone in the media pack say anything otherwise about him, and I think that in itself speaks volumes. As we say, it is easy to be magnanimous with your time and with your kindness, if you like, when you're winning, but I think that so far he's impressed all of us. And the fans as well. I pointed out to him at the media conference earlier that he was the only non-British rider last night to get a cheer from the crowd. I think that's quite remarkable, because it was a fairly small crowd, and you never know how knowledgeable you are with cycling or not, but I look back even to the Giro d'Italia in the first stage win in Belfast, and he was a huge star there. I remember my mum going absolutely crazy because Marcel Kittel had won in Belfast, and he seems to win everybody over, and he's doing it remarkably quickly, and he's doing that obviously because he's winning, but he's doing it with such magnanimous style as well. I think, you know, he's really won everyone over, and he is the star really at the minute, isn't he?
I mean, Daniel, if he was here, would have passed comment by now on his hair. I mean, how was his hair looking today? Maybe I'll ask Lionel. Lionel.
I was thinking about his hair. Sorry, Lionel, you go.
You were thinking about his hair.
While I was doing the interview.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because...
You were studying it.
I was studying it because it was sort of a collapsed quiff, really. Yeah. That's not to say that effort hadn't gone into it, but clearly with the helmet, sometimes he leaves the cap on afterwards, doesn't he, to hide it. I was glad to see that he'd unveiled the quiff. It looked like a bit of a deconstructed version of what he usually wears, but it was still impressive. It still adds to his grandeur, doesn't
it? Tracy Emin, unmade bed version of the Marcel Kittel.
It's exactly what I was thinking, Richard. Exactly what I was thinking.
Now, that's enough about Marcel Kittel's hair, because, you know, I can see Lionel feeling a bit uncomfortable at this point. Lionel, what have you got to say about Marcel Kittel?
Well, other than... backing up what Orla said, I mean, he does draw kind of astonished gasps from people. I don't want to be too stereotypical about it, but a lot of women around at the start, when they saw Kittel go past, it's almost a reflex. You can't help but look at his legs. I mean, they are incredible. He's just a fine specimen, isn't he? And I think in terms of what a race like the Tour of Britain needs, it needs to kind of almost reinforce the who the stars are, and it is so good for the event and for the race and for the people watching on TV and coming out on the roadside that the biggest names in cycling take this event seriously, because that's not always been the case, and that demonstrates that it's just improved in stature every year.
You spoke a little bit to his teammates afterwards as well, I think, Orla. An interesting line from the after stage comments.
Yeah, I caught up with Bert De Backer just afterwards and asked him for his analysis in the stage and whatnot. I hadn't even asked him about Mark Cavendish, actually, but unprompted he said that he thought it was sad, in his words, that Cavendish didn't have the confidence to go for it today. That was his interpretation, which I thought was very interesting, especially given that Cavendish was right up there towards the end, but... And which Marcel Kittel himself pointed out. He said, you never know how a crash can affect you psychologically, whether you had the confidence or not. We don't know, but he was still up there, so he was still going for it. But yeah, Bert De Backer seemed to think that not only because of the fact that he didn't win it, but I think more he was referring to the fact that Giant Shimano had to do all the hard work in the front of the bunch. They were expecting Omega Pharma Quickstep to work a little bit harder. Obviously, when someone crashes, that takes up manpower to bring him back into the bunch. But he thought that they didn't necessarily have their hearts in it today in the way that Giant Shimano did.
Well, the other thing is, Mark Cavendish had that problem with his shoe plate early in the stage. Only 8 or 10 kilometres in, he was sitting on the road with an Allen key, tightening up his own shoe plate, and then... because there's no race radios, the message didn't get to his teammates, so nobody really dropped back to help him get back onto the bunch. He must have lost a good, you know, 90 seconds, 2 minutes, and then he had to work his way back up. As we heard after the stage, when he visited the toilet and was riding back on and crashed into the back of a team car, we gather. So it's really been a sort of catalogue of misfortune for Cavendish. And then in terms of Giant Shimano's lead out, Richard, you said earlier about... sometimes hard to tell what they do, but they did make the decisive move. One of Kittel's teammates made the move to close down Adam Blythe, who'd taken that flyer in the last 500 metres. So their work maybe isn't as show OKC sometimes, as HTC Columbia were and the Omega Pharma Quick Step sometimes are, but they're very effective at getting Kittel into the right place.
Adam Blythe almost caught them by surprise again, like he did at the London Surrey Classic. I just spoke briefly to Brian Holm after the stage today, and he said that after the Cavendish's crash, he had said he didn't want to sprint, and he wasn't wanting to sprint, and he wanted Renshaw to sprint instead, and Renshaw didn't want to sprint either because he'd also crashed. So I think perhaps you know, the other teams, the other riders, the other sprinters have a sense of who's present in the finale, and perhaps Cavendish was not present for a lot of the final few Ks and did pop up at the end, but perhaps he just wasn't making his presence felt, and that's why they felt that he wasn't participating.
Well, I think that a crash is one thing, but to have him sitting by the side of the road fixing his shoes, that's the kind of thing that will make Mark Cavendish supremely angry. He is fastidious with his preparations. He, as long as he makes it to the line and he's done everything that he can do in terms of bike preparation, mechanics have done everything they can do, that everything is perfect, and he loses, then he takes it on the chin. But if something hasn't been prepared right, if something's gone wrong technically, mechanically, anything like that, is guaranteed to get him in a bad headspace. And
although I would say his shoe plates, I think the position of his shoe, he wasn't tightening his shoe plates. It wasn't that they were loose. He was actually moving them a bit, adjusting them a bit, and that really is the responsibility of the rider. You know, in terms of, that's such a personal thing. I don't think a mechanic can ever get the shoe plates right on someone's shoes. So that was maybe a personal oversight, or maybe there was maybe they just loosened off or something. I don't know, but it's unusual to see that.
And sorry, I'm not necessarily saying obviously that either he would blame the mechanic or that I would say that it was anyone else's fault, but it's those kind of minute details that he always takes such care over. So whether that wasn't the case today or whether something went wrong, it's those things that annoy him the most, though. You know, anyone can crash. He's the first to know that. He'll be the first to say whoever's fault it is, that's just bike racing. But when it comes to those little details, the things that should be sorted and aren't sorted, whether it's his responsibility or somebody else's, I think that's the kind of thing that will disrupt his momentum more than anything.
Just on shoe plates still, though. I mean, if things are going well, or things are not going well, rather, it's often shoe plates that are... that become the focus of all the perceived problems that you have riding the bike. You know, if something just doesn't feel right, if you're not going well, if something feels different, the shoe plates can become an obsession. It's weird because there's such minute adjustments you can make to them, and you become so preoccupied with there being a problem with, you know, one being too far forward, too far back, aligned slightly wrongly. It's funny how if things aren't going well, all your sort of problems, perceived problems, can be focused on that little issue. It's weird.
Yeah, it's the same with saddle height or stem length or handlebar angle or any of those things.
And shoe plates in particular.
Yeah, very, very possibly. Yeah, because it's
the
point of contact with the man and the bike. Mm. And when a rider is going well, they feel in harmony with the, you know, man and machine. Feel like they've been put together and fit together perfectly, and then if Cavendish is struggling and it just doesn't feel like it used to feel, then he will focus in, I'm sure, on those little details. And I mean, the sport is littered with the kind of anecdotes of riders complaining about these tiny little details, and I can't remember the name of the rider during a tour probably 10 years ago, complaining to his mechanic about his saddle height, and the mechanic sort of said, yeah, leave it with me, don't worry, I'll sort it out. And then the next day the rider said, oh, thanks very much for altering my saddle and doing what I wanted, and the mechanic hadn't touched it, hadn't moved it up or down.
I think it was Cavendish. I heard that story about him anyway. But yeah, the shoe plates, it's interesting, it's like a rather bizarre analogy, but it's like ballerinas in their shoes. The top ballerinas will always say when things aren't going right, they'll blame their shoes. And it's obviously, not obviously, I've never been a ballerina, believe it or not. But one would imagine it's a psychological thing. And as you say, it's that connection through your whole body and the point of contact. So I would imagine it's something in the head
It is something that you can adjust and never be quite happy with. Another, you know, it can be height of brake levers as well. You're never convinced they're both at the same height. And then, you know, different riders are different. There are, you know, we know back in 1983, sorry, Bernardino riding the Vuelta, I think maybe his saddle was replaced or something, and the height difference was millimetres, but it was enough to injure his knee quite badly. And I know from on Team Sky, they've got what they call macro adjusters and micro adjusters. And Geraint Thomas rode half of a stage of the Tour de France one year on somebody else's bike and didn't realise it. He got someone else's bike as a spare. Whereas Ben Swift, any kind of change there and he feels it. So there's different types.
Yeah, Cavendish rode one stage of the Tour last year with one crank slightly longer than the other.
Yeah.
I think it was the one where he was beaten, one of the ones where he was beaten by Kittel. It doesn't narrow it down too much. Maybe that's a bit harsh. That's just a joke, Mark, if you're listening, which you're bound to be. Orla mentioned ballerinas there, and as a seamless shift to our next segment, Daniel Freeb, friend of the podcast, occasional co-host. Daniel, if you're listening.
Part-time ballerina.
Yeah, he made quite a nice analogy on Twitter today. He's written a fantastic piece about Frank Vandenbroek, the late... I was going to say late great, but really his career and life was so chequered. But Daniel has written a terrific piece about the year 1999 when Frank Vandenbroek dominated the Vuelta's mountain stages, a real sort of insight into the fragile psyche, but that momentary kind of indomitable strength that Vandenbroek had that summer. And it's on cyclingnews.com if you want to check that out. But he was talking about what a great position on the bike and what a great pedaling style Vandenbroek had when he was really on form. And he compared him to Nureyev, the ballerina. And then somebody else said, Chris Froome is kind of the anti-Vandenbroek in the sense of the way he looks on a bike. I thought perhaps Nijinsky. You know, Froome's more Nijinsky than Nureyev. I don't know what you think about that, Richard.
Yeah, I had another sort of obsessive-compulsive disorder story because I shook the hand of Charlie Wigelius at the start and almost immediately he reached for the hand cleanser and started scrubbing.
I'm obsessive-compulsive. I think that comes with shaking hands with you, Richard.
I'm going to call him Lady Macbeth from now on. But anyway, shall we move on to Vuelta?
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
That's really caught fire the last couple of days. Saturday's stage, they're in Asturias and the climbs there are not the sort of long sort of Pyrenean or Alpine passes that are a staple of the Tour and obviously of the Vuelta as well, but they're short, steep, technical, often unknown climbs and, you know, producing some really exciting racing. And Froome right back in it. He's still third. Contador looking vulnerable in places, but Sunday evening. Again, he was strong today and does look quite likely. But it's still quite evenly balanced. Valverde's having good days and bad days. Nobody is really dominating very convincingly. And you know, I think you spoke to Rod Ellingworth, didn't you, Lionel, about Froome and the Vuelta?
Yeah, Rod's been out. He was at the Vuelta for a week. He wasn't really there in his kind of race coach capacity particularly. He's there meeting Dave Brailsford, talking about next season. I presume talking to riders maybe who are joining the team, perhaps. But he did sort of give a bit of an insight into how Chris Froome is going, and that despite the fact that he's been yo-yoing off the back in these mountain stages, not looking as dominant, nowhere near as dominant as he did in the Tour de France last year, and he's climbing in a completely different way. Rod kind of confirmed that Froome is using what he's got in the tank, and he's not putting himself in the red. So he's dropping off kind of as a matter of choice and then choosing his moments to get back in and basically trying to judge. And we can make the jokes about the power meter on his handlebars, but he's making a supreme judgment every single day, every single climb, to try and get the most that he possibly can out of whatever condition he's got. So I spoke to Rod a little bit about that, and this was after the opening stage of the Tour of Britain. Rod's flown back into the UK for the Tour of Britain this week, so here he is, Rod Ellingworth.
Considering, you know, I think like most of the guys who have an accident in the Tour and then you're not got long before the Vuelta, you're never 100% sure where they're at, you know. But yeah, Chris has done a good job. He did a great ride yesterday. I think today, you know, he's just lost about 10 seconds or something, but again, you know, another good ride really. So, you know, he's fighting every day, and that's all you can ask for, isn't it? 100% every day.
Yeah, we're not used to seeing him kind of yo-yo off the back of groups that way. Is that because he's just fighting to sort of discover his form a bit?
Well, I think he's, you know, he's not trying to go into the red and do the big attacks and everything, so I think he's just trying to hold an even pace and, you know, ride his own race, if you like, and then if they're a long way ahead of him, that's how it'll be. But you know, at the moment he's doing a really good job. Yeah,
What's the mood in the camp with regard to how Alberto Contador's been riding? Because from the outside, it's a real surprise that he's going as well as he is, and he's obviously played a brilliant game of bluff.
Yeah, it's phenomenal that he's come back the way he has come back, you know. But, you know, he's a talent, and he always has been a fantastic talent. And I think, you know, his team around him isn't super strong, but you never know with Contador. He's so good. When he's on his own like he was there today, he can cover the move. So, you know, I was a bit surprised on yesterday's finish that he wasn't a bit better. But, you know, I think it looks like he's, you know, he's going to be hard to beat. Yeah.
In terms of your role, is it hard when you're in a race for a week and then you come out again and leave them to it, and then you have to refocus on a different role at a different race?
Well, I mean, you know, I was pretty much out of the Vuelta just to meet people and do a few things, so I wasn't really involved in the performance of the team out there, really. But, yeah, you know, I think sometimes it can be quite hard, but, you know, I think it's quite easy coming in here, and the guys have done a good job setting up for the Tour Britain, and good place to be, good weather, so could be worse.
When you say meeting a few people, is that transfer related people you're meeting?
Well, just all sorts of people, really. You know, Dave Brailsford was out there, Tim Kerrison was out there, so we got together, you know, about future plans of the team, and then just sort of catching up with people, you know, and just, you know, so this is always the time to get talking to other people and start to think about next year, you know.
And in terms of the Tour of Britain, you come here and the focus is so huge on Team Sky and on Bradley Wiggins, isn't it? Did it make it, in a way, a quite a stressful week, because you're mobbed wherever you guys go? I mean, the crowd here, the race finished half an hour, 40 minutes ago, and the crowd around the bus is still huge, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's easy to say it's, you know, it can be a hassle, but it's actually good, you know, and I think this is what we've always wanted, you know, and I think having this amount of people around just shows where cycling's gone in the last few years, you know, and I think Team Sky has had a huge part to play in that, you know. So I find it really exciting, you know, and I think for the lads it's a quite a buzz for them to come here, and we've got Young now here, you know, who I think he's quite, you know, overawed with it all, really, you know. And Brad's doing a great job with the crowds and everything, so I think by the looks of it the guys are really enjoying themselves. Yeah.
In terms of Wiggins, he put a turn on at the front to try and keep the pace high, part of the lead out for Ben Swift, but that indicates to me as an outsider that he's got his race head on this week. Is that how it is? Is he looking at the overall again, do you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Brad's clearly stated he wants to go for the overall, you know, and again, I think the course suits him pretty well, so, you know, there's no sort of no hassle there with him. I think he's good. I think that does show, like you say, today, his commitment to the team and how he wants to race. And, you know, we saw in the 2012 Tour when he won, you know, and Cav being in the team, Brad was happy to go on the front and do a few kilometres turn. And I think as an opener in a stage, you know, it's a nice little effort he's done at the end there.
And in terms of Ben Swift, is this a good warm-up for the World Championships? There's a long stage from Bath to Hemel-Hempstead at the end of the week. That will give a bit of preparation for a race that's as long and as durable as the World Championships. But yeah. Do you think it's enough, or do you think guys who ride here are a slight disadvantage compared to those that do the Vuelta?
I think that, you know, there's several ways to being good for the Worlds, and I think for Ben this was what we believe was his best shot. You know, I don't think Ben is... History has shown for Ben that he doesn't come out a Grand Tour super fresh, you know, he digs himself quite deep, so I don't think the Vuelta was an option for Ben, so for him this is the best option. Yeah, and I think, you know, okay, some of the stages aren't super long here, but they're good, short, sharp. He'll be in the mix on quite a lot of the finishes, so that's what he needs, you know. You can add the rest in, you know, you can do an extra 30-40 k's if you wanted a day, you know, to get what you perhaps would at the Vuelta in a way.
So is that something they might look at a bit later in the week, just to get some more miles in the legs?
We've talked about it, but I'm not sure yet. You know, we did with Cav in 2011, you know, we did a lot of that at this time, you know. But we'll see. I think first and foremost is about the team. I think first and foremost Ben wants to try and win here, do something here, and, you know, and if Brad's there on GC supporting Brad as well, so that's the priority, really.
After his third place at Milan-San Remo in the early part of the year, Ben Swift, he's moved himself onto that kind of list of B or C favourites for the World Championship. Do you think the course in Ponferrada can suit him, or do you think it's going to be more of a sort of climbers, Alejandro Valverde type of course?
Well, I think it could. That's what makes this course so good. It's open to loads of people, I think, you know. So it just depends how hard they race it. I certainly think Swifty could perform there. It's certainly not a sprinter, through and through sprinter, but for sure he could perform there. So, you know, but if it's hard enough, it could be a Valverde, you know. It suit him, Sagan, Gilbert, all them sort of classic sort of riders, it suits well, actually.
And lastly, when you were on the bus earlier this afternoon, what did you have on the big telly? Did you have this stage on here, or did you have the Vuelta on?
We had both on.
You got two screens in there, have you?
Two screens, yeah. So we had both races on. Yeah, so it's quite ironic, because obviously the tour been finished, and I think the Vuelta still had like 3K to go, but all the lads got straight in. None of them had got changed. That's why we're still here, and they all were glued to the telly, you know. So, so it's been good, actually. Good spirit.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Okay, welcome back to the Telegraph Bally Podcast. I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney, Orla Shinawi. Must recommend a fantastic book about Rudolf Nureyev. It's a fictionalised book. It's a fictionalised version of his life by Colin McCann, the Irish writer. It's called Dancer, and it's a tremendous book about Rudolf Nureyev. Orla, you were asking me there while we were listening to Rod Ellingworth, what the link was between Bally and Charlie Wigelius.
Well, I thought it was a terribly clumsy way for you to get away from Lionel's question about Bally by just saying, Anyway, I shook hands with Charlie Wigelius earlier.
I was protecting Lionel because I could see the uncertainty on his face about whether he wasn't that confident about what he just said, so I was actually digging him out of a hole, but thanks for drawing attention to that.
Well, when I said Nijinsky and Chris Froome, I was thinking of the racehorse and Chris Froome's kind of almost galloping style where arms and legs seem to work. If you look at the way he climbs with his elbows out and his knees sometimes out and his kind of... It does look like...
It's not that, overt. Sorry.
Yeah, and... But there's also a ballet... But there was a ballet
of course,
dancer.
I thought that's what you meant, the ballet dancer.
Well, Nijinsky. No, there's an obscure ballet dancer called Nijinsky, Wikipedia
Russian.
Tells me.
Russian,
that's right.
Me, Jim Height.
Clumsy dancer.
A tremendous dancer in his day.
Wikipedia.
Anyway, it's a beautiful evening here in Liverpool. The sun is still high in the sky. There's a Stena Line boat.
Off to Belfast, by the looks of
off
it.
Off to Belfast, floating by. Any pangs, Orla, would you like to be on that boat?
Well, it's a bit of a swim to get onto it, so I'm happy enough here. Thanks very much.
Yeah,
in
your state, I wouldn't recommend that.
I'd float, though, eh?
You would float. Anyway, enough. Orla, have you been able to watch much of the Vuelta?
Haven't really been able to watch much. I've been following it, as everyone else has been. I was chatting to Rod as well about it earlier and asking him about form within the team. And he seems to think that they're all really growing in confidence and Chris is growing in confidence. I think it's probably fair to say that he didn't really know how he was going to fare going into it. I flew out to... the Team Sky house in Nice just before the Vuelta, and he was reluctant to commit as to whether he was going for the win or whether he was... What he said actually was that he just wanted to get some more Grand Tour racing in his legs, which is sensible given the season that he's had. But it seems that he is getting more and more confident. We can see that, obviously, that's translated into his times. Rod said that on Saturday's stage, if the last climb had been a little bit longer, he would have dropped everyone. But yeah, I'm following it all from afar and intrigued from afar as well. I think just seeing how Contador is going to finish off the race will be very interesting, given how he said he'd wait till week three before we'd be able to see anything from him. Of course, in week one, he paid to that. So yeah, I think it's been an interesting race.
Sorry to take you on a bit of a tangent, but you mentioned the Team Sky house in Nice, and this is a base that they've been talking about setting up for a while. I've not been out there. I don't think you've been out there, Lionel. This is quite new this year. What's the setup like there?
It's more of a drop-in centre rather than anything else. I don't believe anyone really stays there. Lots of the guys have houses down the hill in Monaco, and it's just a handy base for everyone. I think that they kind of drop in and out whenever they've got a moment. Tim Kerrison was out there. He was devising Chris's training plan. They hooked up afterwards to talk through what Chris had done on the day and what he was going to do for the next day. So it's a bit of a logistical base more than anything else. It's a fine place. They've got posters everywhere. It's quite homely.
They were talking about making it a sort of cafe for fans as well, a place for fans of the team to go and hang out. Is that any further to happening or
no further at this stage? No, it's very much a Team Sky base more than anything
functional.
Else it's functional, yeah, yeah.
That's anyway, back it. To the Vuelta, Lionel, what are your thoughts going to this final week? Good performance today from Warren Barguil, the young Frenchman. If Daniel was here, he would tell us all kinds of things about Warren Barguil and things that nobody knows about his parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. an extended family and coaches and all the rest of it. But he is somebody we've talked about, you know, he's spoken about as being perhaps the best prospect of this young French generation. And he rode extremely well today, and perhaps we can see more of him in the final week.
Yeah, I think the top 10 has split into two halves, really, hasn't it? Or certainly the top four have broken away. That's Contador, Froome, Rodriguez and Valverde, of course. How could we forget Valverde, lying second overall still? And then the bottom half of the top 10 is exactly that. It's Warren Barguil, it's Fabio Aru, it's Dan Martin, the stage hunters, people who make it hard in the mountains and are looking for stage wins but have ridden high into the overall but aren't going to win. I think the thing about the Vuelta, which we talked about last week, and it's kind of coming true again, is that the last week of the Vuelta it's going to be these four guys at the top, and we're either going to see the four of them ride to the finish in kind of more or less the same order they are at the moment. Chris Froome is only 120 back, as in 130 back, sorry, as is
120.
It is 120, yeah, 120 back, as is Joachim Rodriguez. That's a lot to make up, even though they are going to have to ride all these medium mountain and mountain stages. The final time trial is only 12.5 kilometres, I think, so not a lot of opportunity to make up time there. It all hinges on whether Contador holds it together. He needs to have a bad day for anyone else to have a chance. I mean, Valverde, he follows and follows and follows. He's very good at marking that key move. If Rodriguez jumps, he will, you know, stick to him and hope that that's enough to crack Contador. But I don't know whether Valverde is going to actually push the boat out himself.
Yeah, those three, Valverde, Contador, Rodriguez, they are sticking to each other like limpets. And today, Sunday, they rode quite conservatively, sort of protecting their own interests rather than, say, distancing Froome when he was off the back. And somebody did make the point on Twitter that those three have been a sort of a golden generation, if you like, slightly marred in a couple of cases, or tarnished. But they've been a very dominant sort of generation of Spanish stage racers now for a few years. And who's coming up beneath them in Spain? It's hard to tell. One thing in Vuelta, watching it, has been the crowds. The crowds have been terrific, actually, and I'm sure that's helped by the fact that they've got these local heroes to cheer on, and see Contador especially. But are there many good Spanish riders coming up?
Well, you're testing me a bit there. I mean, certainly not that have moved through. I mean, if you look at really Movistar's, you know, their big hope for the next 6-7 years is going to be Nairo Quintana, Colombian. The Colombian riders are the ones, you know, there's so many of them. I mean, if AG2R or somebody else can sort out Carlos Betancur, really, they've got five or six. Sebastian Henao at Sky, you know, a lot of talk about him being very talented. We'll see. It's not really his kind of race here, the Tour of Britain, but he'll get a taste of some of the hills a bit later on this week. But the thing about the race in Spain being so popular, not just due to Contador's popularity, but also I think the economic hard times in Spain, cycle racing is a cheap, almost free day out. All you need is a means to get to the climbs and a picnic. You know, you see people riding or walking up the mountains at the Tour. It's their kind of what they build their summer holiday around almost. And I think the Vuelta's increase in crowds in the last few years has coincided, I think, with the fact that Spain's going through quite a hard time economically, and the popularity of the sport in the 80s was largely down to the fact that, again, that was times of hardship in Spain.
Yeah, absolutely. We've commented on that before, and Andy Hood, our colleague, has spoken quite a lot about that as well. We should probably wrap things up. Orla, anything more to add about the... you're on the Tour of Britain, so I won't put you on the spot again about Vuelta, but the Tour of Britain this week, what are you looking forward to in particular?
I'm looking forward to Tumble in Wales. Lots of riders have mentioned that, so I think we should see some interesting things there. Marcel Kittel seemed to think that tomorrow could be an interesting stage as well.
This might go out after that, so we might
have
to pretend.
That'll be Monday then.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting stage on Monday.
Just as predicted. But yeah, I think Tumble, I think the time trial, obviously, it's shorter than last year, but it still could be quite decisive. I'm just really interested to see what Bradley Wiggins can do, to be honest, with a strong team behind him. He does have a strong team, and with the local crowds behind him, with a bit of a swagger back. I'm really excited to see what he can produce this week.
Nobody looking forward to Hemel Hempstead? surely.
I'm looking forward to going out for dinner near to Hemel Hempstead that evening, Lionel. I think we're going out for a fancy-ish dinner. So I look forward to that. Anyway, let's wrap it up there, and we finished our ice creams, and thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Orla.
Thank you, and thank you for the ice cream. It was delicious. I'm a cheap date.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.